Hello and welcome to the Weekly Space Hangout for Wednesday, September 9th, 2020, our all-new season. I have no idea what season this is. Maybe someone will tell me. This week, we're going to be talking about a gigantic search for aliens. Crazy planetary rings in a triple star system. We're going to see the new NASA SRB booster tested and more. Joining me this week on my screen, I've got Beth Johnson. Beth, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to see you again, Fraser.
Good to see you as well. We've got Alan Versfeld. Alan.
Hey, nice to see you again.
Yeah. And we've got Nika Klimich. Nika, thank you as always for getting up at like 3 in the morning to join us.
Thank you as always that I can join and be here with you guys.
All right. So before we get on to this week's show, I want to just give a huge thank you to our good friends at the Weekly Space Hangout crew for, I mean, as always, the purpose of the Weekly Space Hangout crew is for the fans of the show and space to just huddle together and try to make it through the summer. And of course, this summer was particularly difficult, but we're back. And Nancy has been hard at work organizing all of the fall schedule, all the cool stuff we're going to be doing. So definitely thank you, Nancy. Thanks to everyone of the Weekly Space Hangout crew. And if you want to be a member of this community, just go to wshcrew.space. And then you just get to be an executive producer of this show. You just tell us what to do. It's all up to you. All right. So let's get on with this week's show. And we've got our guest, Dr. Katie Mack. Katie, welcome back, I think, to the Weekly Space Hangout.
Yes, I think I was last on it in 2015 or something like that. It's been a while.
Yeah. And of course, The reason why is this week you've got, this time around, you've got a new book.
I do, yeah.
Do you have a physical copy?
I've got this book. Yeah.
The end of everything.
Yes.
Astrophysically speaking.
We had to add that subtitle so that people would know we were being very literal when we were talking about the end of everything. It really is everything in the universe.
Right.
It's my new book about the end of the universe and how that might happen and what it would look like and all of that.
Like many people, I am absolutely fascinated by this topic. One of the things that I find really interesting is thinking about the end of everything causes people with a certain amount of, I don't know, emotional sadness that however it ends up, it's inevitable, even though the timescales cannot be calculated. You're just barely, yeah. You know, you wrap your head around how far it's going to be. What's that about?
It's very strange. I think it's a couple of things. I think it's one is just that we get attached to stuff, and if everything is going to be destroyed at some point, like that's, you know, we have a sort of visceral response to that because we don't want everything to be destroyed. And also I think there's, if you think about it a little bit too hard, then you end up with a worse problem, because when you think about your own death or something like that, you know, even the death of humanity at some level, like something might live on, right? There could be, you know, something that you did could have a positive consequence. You could have, you know, a legacy, great works, children, whatever, like something might live on. But if the whole universe is going to end at some point, like nothing matters, right? In a very literal sense. And that's deeply troubling if you think about it too much. And definitely while I was writing the book, I was struggling with this idea that maybe at some point the legacy of everyone and everything will be utterly erased. And that's hard to accept.
But at every scale, you know, when I tell people, when I talk to people about the lifetime of the solar system, and they say, oh, well, you know, it's only 4.5 billion years, whatever, until the sun blows up as a red giant and wipes out all the planets. And they're like, oh, we got a long time. And you go, well, we actually don't, because it's really only about 500 billion years before the sun heats up to the point that it boils off the oceans of the earth, you know, 500 to a billion years. And they're like, oh, and they're sadder now because, you know, that's sooner. Yeah. We've got less time, you know?
Right.
We got to quickly get through our bucket list before the oceans boil away.
It is a very strange thing, and I think it partially comes down to the fact that humans have never really figured out how to conceptualize those kinds of scales, time scales, distance scales. You know, we kind of, you know, most of the time when you think of the difference between a million and a billion, you kind of think, well, like, yeah, about double, right? Like, it's not at all anything like that, but in your mind it's like, oh, there's a million and there's a billion, like, okay, like that, you know. But no, it doesn't work like that at all. And I think that's just, we compress everything, we conceptualize everything as being sort of reachable in some way, and it's not. And so we just, our brains don't do well with those kinds of scales and you know, sizes.
Yeah. And just as, I mean, what are some of the, some of the future things that will happen as we sort of push into deep time, that I think about these things about, like, how, say, as dark energy continues to accelerate the expansion of the universe, and then everything will slip over the cosmic horizon and just disappear mm-hmm. from our point of view. And then eventually mm-hmm. things, you know, photons of light will be stretched across light years and be utterly yeah. invisible.
Yeah. I mean, the big milestones, I think, for our cosmic future. I mean, one is the destruction of the Earth, right? That's it depends on how you measure it, but somewhere in the billion to several billion year mark, the Earth becomes uninhabitable and destroyed. And then there's, in 100 billion years, we are no longer able to see other galaxies because they're all too far away and moving away too quickly. And also at that point, we lose all evidence for the Big Bang because the background light, the cosmic microwave background light from the Big Bang is stretched out too long for us to possibly see it. And then at some point, the last stars are going to die, and the timescales on that kind of vary. But, you know, in the hundreds of billions of years life span, that's when you lose stars. And then, you know, and then after that, it's a matter of black holes evaporating. So, you know, a black hole of about 5 solar masses, which is the sort of smallest ones we know about, that takes somewhere on order of 10 to the 69 years, 10 to the 70, somewhere in that range. So, you know, you've got that time scale. And then, you know, the proton decay is probably earlier than that, probably like 10 to the 40-ish years. And then it's just a matter of, like, getting darker and emptier and everything kind of fading away. And there have been some interesting suggestions of weird kinds of like white dwarf or white dwarf remnants exploding.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
1,000 years.
Yeah, no, it's 10 to the power of 2,200.
2,200.
Yeah.
So maybe that happens, but that only works if protons don't decay. So, you know, we don't know. But I mean, by that time already, I feel like timescales are no longer meaningful or useful at that stage. And then all that's left after that is the ultimate heat death, which is when nothing can happen anymore because you've reached maximum entropy. And the arrow of time is no longer meaningful.
But is there a maximum entropy, or is it just a sliding scale? Like,
no, you do reach a maximum entropy, because if you are in a universe that is accelerating in its expansion, then after a while, the universe is basically just dark energy, at least in, you know, in any cosmic volume. And there's an entropy associated with the sort of cosmic horizon. There's a temperature associated with the cosmic horizon, and there's a sort of entropy that can be calculated for the region of, you know, that anyone could observe in a universe like that. So if you could somehow decay everything but leave an observer there to measure stuff, you could calculate the maximum entropy, and that would just be fixed.
Right.
Because you'd be in this sort of, like, a steady state universe, one that's accelerating in its expansion all the time, but has this cosmic horizon that's sort of at this fixed scale. And, And then, you know, it's maximum entropy, which means that the second law of thermodynamics no longer can allow entropy to increase in the future, which means there is no future. It means that the arrow of time no longer exists. Yep. if you measure the arrow of time in that way. So time keeps happening, but it has no direction, which is weird.
Yep.
And nothing substantial can really happen. Nothing can really change in any meaningful way, because in order for something to happen, you would need entropy to be increasing, and it can't increase anymore. So all you have is sort of random fluctuations out of the vacuum, which themselves can be interesting. You can right. have something randomly fluctuate out, you know, a whole new universe or a galaxy or
right,
or,
right,
depending
right.
on how you calculate it.
Yeah, but, I remember someone had calculated when that would happen, that you could have a moment where the entire universe could essentially reassemble itself into a big bang if you're just waiting for the quantum fluctuations yeah. long enough.
So the wild, there are several wild things about that. One of them is that depending on what kinds of assumptions you make about how entropy fluctuates in these kinds of scenarios, you can have a situation where you can spontaneously recreate the entire universe at any state it has been in through its lifetime, right? So you could refluctuate, you know, reassemble the universe as it is exactly right now at this moment, with us sitting here talking to each other.
Yep.
And then it would just, you know, carry on from here to a heat death.
Right.
And
an infinite number of times.
An infinite number of right. times. And this is called the Poincaré recurrence. And this is something that people actually talk about as a possibility in cosmology in a post-heat death universe, that you could yep. just have a repeat of every moment of your life, like an infinite number of times. And also like a slight tweak to that, where like I'm wearing a red shirt
sure.
in the next yeah, yeah, yeah. version,
yeah.
you know, and then repeat that infinitely. Because if you're working with infinite time and no direction of it and random fluctuations, anything and everything can happen. And it's a super bizarre place that you end up. And then you get Boltzmann brains, which is a yeah. whole other thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's very weird.
Yeah, and so, I mean, like, infinity has that way of getting weird.
Yeah. Yeah, and it doesn't even have to be technically infinite. It could just be extremely long time scales.
Yeah.
But, you know, as I talk about in my book, there are other ways that the universe can end that don't have that sort of, you know, free for all infinity at the end, where the universe does get actually destroyed. And that's that can get very exciting and violent in some ways.
I know you covered the Big Rip in the book. And right now, like where we stand today, while we're still waiting for, say, the Nancy Roman telescope to launch, or waiting for the Dark Energy Survey to give us a final outcome, where do you think we're standing right now on the likelihood of the Big Rip tearing the universe apart?
Right. So whether or not we're going to have a Big Rip depends on whether we have a cosmological constant dark energy or something else. And the important parameter to measure is called the equation of state parameter, W. If that parameter is exactly equal to -1, then we have a cosmological constant. We get a heat death. Everything fades away. Weird stuff happens in the heat death. Or if it's anything less than -1, you get a Big Rip, according to you know that theory. And we can't ever have such precision that if the equation of state parameter is exactly -1, we'll never have such perfect precision that we can rule out values slightly above and slightly below it. So if dark energy has this number that's just a little bit below -1, then we get a Big Rip. It's just later, right? So all we can say right now is we can say that we are not going to have a Big Rip, according to current data, within the next about 188 billion years.
Right, right.
So we have around 200 billion years where we can be pretty darn sure that a Big Rip is yeah. not going to happen. Beyond that, though, it's just we're just going to narrow in and push right. that farther and farther out.
So it's unless kind we find, of like yeah. measuring the size of the universe. The better we get at measuring the flatness of the universe, the better we are at saying it's at least this yes. big,
yeah.
but we don't actually right. know how yeah. big it really is.
Yeah, yeah, it's exactly that kind of thing. And you know, and we there are ways that there are reasons that theorists don't like the Big Rip, and we might find a way to rule it out based on just, you know, incompatibility with certain energy conditions or whatever. And you can rule it out based on those things. You just don't know for sure that those things really hold. So if we have a better idea of the theoretical constraints, then we might be able to say, well, a Big Rip is just totally impossible. But in terms of timescales, we're just going to push it farther and farther into
right,
the future.
Right. So sort of in writing this book, what is like mm-hmm. a rabbit hole that you went down that you weren't even expecting to just get pretty excited about, and it sort of consumed mountains of your work, and you're calling researchers, you're double checking people's math. There must have been something.
There are so many cool little things in this book. I really wanted to put all of my favorite strange little astrophysical or cosmological quirks into this book. So, like, so I mean, recalculating the time scale of the Big Rip is one of them. There was so one of the chapters of the book is called Bounce, and it's about bouncing or cyclic cosmologies, mm-hmm. where you have an end of the universe and a new beginning. And while I was writing that chapter, new papers were coming out with new models of bouncing cosmologies that were updates to the models I'd already written into the chapter.
Right.
So I spent a lot of time frantically emailing and calling cosmologists, being like, okay, what's the current idea on this?
Right.
And one of the people who was revising those models was Paul Steinhardt, who was my PhD advisor. And so I really felt like I needed to get that right.
Right.
So I spent a lot of time emailing with him and reading his latest papers and trying to update what I'd already written in the chapter. And you know, that was definitely a rabbit hole. And then another new model came out while I was writing the chapter as well, from colleagues of mine at the Perimeter Institute, where I was visiting at some point. So that also required some quick revisions. So you know, there were a few things like that where it's just a very active field. And then, you know, renaming getting the Vera Rubin Observatory name in there, that happened while I was writing the book. And so did Jim Peebles' Nobel Prize. So I added a note about that. You know, it's a really active field right now, and there's a lot that's going on.
If there was like a future, if future Katie Mack gets access to a time machine and can send you back some observation which you're hoping to see in the future, mm-hmm. to help you provide some resolution to some question in the book, what are you most looking forward to right now?
Ooh, I mean, if we're ever going to detect primordial gravitational waves and really be sure that cosmic inflation happened, that would be super helpful.
Yeah.
For the book. Understanding dark matter, it doesn't make that big a difference in the book. I just really want to know.
Right. Right.
Like what dark matter is.
Yeah.
And if dark energy is anything other than a cosmological constant, I definitely need to know that. And then, you know, there's other stuff like particle physics theories. So one of the models in the book that I talk about is vacuum decay, which relies on stuff going on with the Higgs field, and things like the Large Hadron Collider are actively trying to measure more about the Higgs field and trying to understand if this is something that it's even possible for it to do. So, you know, if they build that future circular collider, that's like this super powered, much bigger LHC, I want to know what they find in that. And then gravitational waves. You know. If gravitational waves tell us something that, you know, revise our theory of gravity or black holes, or if we are able to finally really tie down the Hubble parameter, the expansion rate of the universe, with gravitational waves or something else, like, I want to know that.
Well, it sounds like either a big revision or a book two.
Well, yeah, I mean, book two is going to be a challenge because I destroyed the universe in book one. It's kind of hard. I don't know how to follow
save,
that.
So save it, might obviously. Be, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. You need to un-Thanos snap it somehow. Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's see the book again, Katie.
Oh, yep, yep. Hold on. There it is. Or if you're in the UK or Australia Commonwealth, so this is the UK version. This is the US North America version.
Awesome. So. Well, congratulations. And I hope everyone watching buys a copy and then you get many more book deals and we get to talk to you again. All right.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me on.
Thanks, Katie.
Bye.
All right. Everyone's noting my camera kind of looks like an old timey photograph. I've got my DSLR hooked up as my webcam, but it's still set with the white balance for outside when I normally film. So I have to modify the white balance on this camera. See, we're figuring this out as we go. All right. That was a lot of fun. Hopefully that was a different take on the conversation with Katie than the ones other people have been doing. We just got right to the good stuff. All right, Veronica, you're on my screen right now. Why don't you tell us about an SRB test? And I will play the test.
Very good. So I just wanted to start this new season with a very optimistic news for plans to have a lunar habitat on the surface of the moon. And as you all well know, there are... the NASA is planning these missions, Artemis missions to the moon. The Artemis 3 mission would bring people to the moon, and beyond the Artemis 3 mission, the NASA will deliver astronauts that will stay on the surface of the moon. And the crew, the astronauts, will be launched by SLS launch vehicle, and very essential part of this vehicle are the two boosters that are basically providing the 75% of the thrust needed to launch this vehicle to the moon. So last week, NASA did the complete full-scale booster test for the SLS Block 1 launch vehicle. And for more than a little of 2 minutes, SLS booster was firing in Utah desert.
So hold on. I want to show people this because it's just amazing. Sure, it here. Looks, okay, hold on a second here. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Here we go.
Three, now you will two, be able to hear it. One, fire.
But people will be able to hear it.
T plus 5 seconds. T plus 10 seconds.
Activate head and CO2. Right.
Activated.
Activate quench talk.
We'll stop that there. So what did we see?
So basically, we saw this firing of this boosters, 5-segment booster, and it was like firing, as I already mentioned, for more than 2 minutes, and that is exactly the time that these boosters will power the rocket for the liftoff and for the flight to the moon. And basically this test was conducted by NASA to test new materials and processes that will be needed for this Artemis missions, like beyond the Artemis 3 missions, basically for landing on the surface of the moon. And the previous one, the previous test for the Artemis 1, 2, 3 are already conducted. And the boosters, the main contractor, I hope I will pronounce it right, the Northrop Grumman. And the good news for the people who are hoping that the landing and the moon habitat are happening, of course, it's a small part. But these small steps will basically help to enable these missions.
The you know, with the Artemis mission, with the space launch system, these solid rocket boosters, I mean, they're very familiar to people. They were the boosters that they used on the space shuttle, but these are bigger than ones that were on the space shuttle.
Right. That's like, I think for the shuttle, they had like 4 segments and now they are like 5 segments. Right. And it is the largest and most powerful boosters that were developed or created for the flights.
Yeah.
So it's pretty astonishing that it's working well.
And they provide, I think, 75% of the propulsion thrust to get the mission to get the rocket out into space. So it's funny. Like, I think, you know, people are talking about this in the chat, that obviously the cost overruns of the space launch system are frustrating. We should have seen this thing launch years ago, and yet
2016 is it?
Yeah, and yet it's a really impressive piece of technology. I mean, to see that scale of a solid rocket booster, to know that it's capable of just hauling that much mass off the planet, nothing else compares. I mean, maybe Starship in the end will, but for now, this is the very pinnacle of power that humanity is able to sort of bring to bear to carry stuff off into space. So very exciting. Have you been following the schedule? When will we see this thing launch? Do you know?
You mean Artemis 1?
Yeah, when is Artemis 1 scheduled now to launch?
Wait, I had this website open. No, I don't.
I think we're looking at the end of 2021. We're going to see the first.
What?
2021 is the first test of the space launch system, and then moving towards the actual flight to Mars by 2024.
Sorry. Yeah, it was 21, one without the Artemis 1 without the crew, and then 23 was with the crew, basically.
Yeah, they were expecting, we should have seen it launching sometime in October-ish 2020, but big surprise, the schedule has slipped to 2021.
Don't
get too comfortable with that schedule either. Who knows what'll happen? The future is uncertain, as we know. Anyway, as Katie told us, we've got a long future ahead of us, so... they cost more of the launch than the Falcon Heavy. Yes, they do. They're very expensive. Awesome. Thanks, Veronica. All right, Beth, what have you got for us?
Let me unmute so I'm not Pamela.
That's classic Pamela.
So today I bring you news of 2 teams of astronomers that used the ALMA Observatory to look at a triple star system. And what they found were these misaligned rings of dust. So this system is GW Orionis, great names. It has 3 stars. The inner 2 orbit about 1 AU apart, so the distance between the Earth and the Sun. And then the outer star orbits the other 2 about 8 AU out. And so these are pretty, you know, comparatively close distances, slightly less than the Earth-Saturn distance for the further one out. And then around these stars, there are these 3 dust rings, and they can't totally be explained by just the star's motions. So the rings orbit at 46, 185, and 385 AU from the center of the system. And the very innermost ring is actually tilted out of the plane with the outer 2 rings. So all 3 dust rings contain sufficient material to form planets. And the inner one actually has enough dust and debris to form about 30 Earths, which is pretty amazing. The teams have been mapping out these 3 stars for about 11 years. And that's pretty much a full orbital period of the entire inner system. And they don't seem to orbit in the same plane either. So what they think is that using computer simulations, they think that because these orbits are not completely aligned, it's causing a disk tearing effect on the system, which is kind of popping that innermost planetary ring out and also causing the gaps in the rings, because the gaps, of course, don't line up with any other stars or anything or any planets that exist. So they haven't found any actual planets, but they're, you know, it would be really cool if in the future we did, because we don't have a planet around a triple star yet.
So, I mean, these are newly forming star systems.
Right, right. So the stars are pretty young, and then you have all the planetary dust that, or the debris disk that's around them from what wasn't eaten up by the stars themselves.
So are they going to survive? Will they get planets? Will they be stable?
They don't know, because we haven't seen one like this before. So, you know, we figured out that you can orbit two stars and remain stable, but orbiting three is kind of a new ball game here. So, we don't know yet. And, so now it's just a matter of kind of like keeping track and looking at it and seeing if we get some planets out of this dust. There's enough material. So it's just a question of, will it stay stable? I mean, they've seen the rings for these 11 years, so they haven't gone away yet. But that's 11 years is very short on a geologic time scale.
Did I get it correct? So is it enough material to build planets in all three rings?
Yes. Yes. So there is enough material in all three rings. It's just the innermost one definitely has enough to build at least 30 Earths. But all three rings have have enough dust for it.
I think, you know, we haven't seen any planets in triple star systems, as you mentioned, and maybe that's the reason. I mean, we're seeing one that is in a newly forming system before the mayhem really caught up and destroyed everything. I guess that's the question, is do we see this being stable in the long term? Is there a way that...
I think the interesting thing for me is that inner ring is tilted out of the what they consider the disk of the other two, so they're not aligned. So I think that's a real big problem for forming planets, because if we're just looking at this early on, what's not to say that disk carrying effect won't continue on and break this up completely? So I'm going to say I'm not terribly optimistic of forming a planet under these conditions, but you know, a lot of people didn't think we could have one around with a binary star either. So, the whole thing about the world is more amazing than your mind can come up with sometimes.
The thing that I love, though, I mean, I think like it's great. We can talk about everything that we're seeing, but to just look at these pictures and to know that we're seeing new planetary systems forming around stars, and we're not seeing them through the transits of, planets passing in front of the star. We are literally seeing the rings of where the newly forming planetary dust rings around these stars. It's just absolutely mind blowing that we can see this now. That this is where the technology is today.
I love the future of telescopes and the fact that we're actually getting this kind of visibility into exoplanets now.
And when you look at the capability of these new, when you look at these new telescopes that are coming online, when we've talked about the European Extremely Large Telescope to death, a 40 plus meter telescope that's going to be capable of observing planets orbiting other stars in this same way. Like right now, ALMA can see these newly forming, the dust disks around newly forming planets, but the next generation of telescopes, the big ones, will show the actual planets of fully mature systems, sun-like stars with planets around.
Well, we can see some of those planets now, because the Gemini Planet Imager has already given us several images of stars with actual planets and seeing those planets.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited for how that resolution is only going to go up.
Yeah. Yeah. I cannot wait. Awesome. All right. Alan, what have you got for us?
So, I suppose Bess will have a lot to say about this. This is in
I want to leave a little time because I think it's going to be a fun conversation. So
So this is a search for extraterrestrial project done with the Murchison Wide Field Array, which is Australia's precursor to the Square Kilometre Array. unlike the one that I'm more familiar with in South Africa. This is looks at lower frequencies, and it has a very, very wide field view. So they are able to do survey searches for SETI signals. And what they did here was to aim at an area in Vela. I think it was centered on the Vela supernova remnant. Vela, if you don't know it, is the constellation of the Sail. It's definitely a southern constellation. So they were able to view an area of about 400 square degrees, and they were specifically looking at FM signals, sort of the middle of the commercial FM radio band up to about 128 megahertz or so. And a total of 17 hours of data, very, very sensitive, looking at very narrow bands, 10 kilohertz each, and they found nothing. So that proves that there are no aliens. We can
right,
go home.
That's it. We can. are no useful aliens.
No. Right. Well, okay. At least specifically, no aliens on the, was it six known exoplanets in that area?
Yeah.
That are using FM radio. That we're broadcasting in January 2018.
within a region of 10 million stars,
yeah.
No helpful aliens so far. Therefore, yeah. There are no aliens.
I think we can extrapolate from that. Yeah,
we just did. It's perfect.
Yeah.
So I guess technically, what were they able to accomplish that's sort of above and beyond? Because it really felt like a just phenomenal increase in sensitivity and scope that they were able to detect using the Murchison array.
Well, that's the gist of it. I mean, it is the most sensitive survey so far of this nature. And of course, it covers a large area. So they're still covering a tiny portion of the sky, but previously you might've looked at a single star, you know, which mm-hmm. is going to take a long time. By focusing on those FM bands, I mean, on Earth at least, that is a very busy part of the spectrum. You know, apart from commercial radio stations, tens of thousands of them, you're also looking at personal two-way radios, you know, police radios. I think air traffic also operates in that band. It's been a while since I've had to work in there. So if it's a civilization that looks like us at our current level, and if they are using very powerful radios, then we should find them using a survey like this. But it does still leave a lot of scope for other possibilities. I mean, I imagine a century from now, we're going to be very radio quiet because we are sending a lot of, you know, everything's becoming digital now. We're transmitting from satellites, which are being at the surface, not up into space. Or we are using the internet, which is all going over fiber optics. But at the same time, I don't think these things are ever going to go away. You know, the police are still going to be using two-way radios or fire departments or emergency services. So, you know, it's not a pointless search by any means. It would have been very, very exciting if they had found something. It just, really, this just means that there's a lot of other options that we should still be looking for before we can rule anything out.
So let's talk a bit about the Murchison array. So what you mentioned this is a precursor to the Square Kilometer Array. What is it?
So in both Australia and South Africa, way back when we were competing to who was going to get the telescope before they decided to divide it between the two nations, each of us, we built these, I say we as if I had anything to do with it.
You did it.
Yeah.
It's like when your team wins. Pride.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah. So we won the World Cup. Yeah.
we built these precursor instruments, to demonstrate the technical ability, to demonstrate the value of the sites that we had chosen. And what we got was two incredible radio telescopes with operating in different bands, you know, looking at different portions of the spectrum, using very different designs. And both of them just utterly defeating everything that existed before. If you look at what Meerkat is producing, the incredible resolution and quite wide field in the higher frequencies, and NWA as well. I mean, 400 square degrees at a time. I can't imagine, you know, but they're doing it, and it's really revolutionizing. And once SKA comes online, once the big one opens up, I think this is going to take it to the next level.
Yeah, to have a telescope that has 1 square kilometer of surface area, not like an interferometer where you've got your two telescopes 1 kilometer apart and they're acting like a telescope that's 1 kilometer apart. There's actually 1 whole kilometer's worth of collection area that's going on. That's even
plus the interferometry.
Plus interferometry, yeah. One is in Australia and one is in South Africa. Okay, so it's an incredible instrument. How much? You talked about they focused on a region in Vela, so it was just like a region of the sky in that constellation.
Yeah. 400 square degrees. I believe there's, I'll have to double check my maths, I think it's about 41,000 square degrees in the entire sky.
Right. I'm sort of imagining the moon, right? The moon is half a degree. So you've got square root of 400, like 20. You've got like 40 moons by 40 moons.
Yeah. I mean, I think my binoculars give me a field of probably about 8 square degrees, maybe a little bit more.
So it's a huge chunk of the sky.
It's a big chunk.
Yeah. And I guess, and they're specifically looking in this FM band.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. This is the third time they've done something like this. Previously, they were looking directly opposite the galactic core, and second time I think it was in the sort of around Orion, slightly different frequencies, but these are very busy frequencies. So I suppose the idea is, if it's a technology like ours currently, then there will be strong signals. Although at the same time, these tend to be quite weak signals. Mm-hmm. You know, they don't propagate very well. So we only use them. You know, you're not listening to an FM station 1,000 kilometers away,
right,
the way you might listen to a shortwave station.
Well, would they be, I guess, like, is the expectation in this that they would actually be broadcasting a signal directly towards the Earth with intention to communicate with us, as opposed to, like I know that the Square Kilometer Array, once it's actually fully operational, will be able to detect leaked radio emissions out to a range of about, I think, about 100 light years away. But in this case, you're still looking for signals that are being directed at us, as opposed to just, you know, their television shows and propaganda being broadcast into space accidentally.
You know, it's funny. I worked with radio for a long time. I don't think this is such a great, and I'm wide open to correction here. I don't think it is what you would choose if you were trying to communicate over very long distances.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't go around corners so well. It doesn't penetrate walls as well. Although it's going through space, maybe that's not such an issue. but I mean, I remember the very first, if I'm remembering correctly, the very first SETI searches were looking at bands more like the hydrogen absorption. What's it called again? It's the H1 signal, which is 2.7 gigahertz, if I recall.
Okay. The emission line or the absorption line for neutral hydrogen.
That's the one, yeah. Okay. Because that's, you will get an extreme range on that one.
Yeah.
So I don't know what an alien would do, but I imagine that. So this is more likely to be leaked signals if it was.
So
what
I
would
guess
be the better option? Oh, sorry.
Oh, go ahead, Veronica. Mm.
So what would be the better option to check for? What will be the next survey, which will make more sense? Maybe.
That is a good question,
Beth. You work with an organization that focuses on this kind of thing. This must
so
have crossed your desk.
Yeah, so we're focusing, we have two new searches kind of active right now. One is more of an optical study, so instead of the radio waves, we're looking for more visible light, and one is a laser study. So that one is still being built, but again, we're trying to get more of the sort of the same kind of map, you know, observing more of the sky at one time than just, you know, pick a star, which is what we've been doing. So
I mean, it's even more than that. It's like you point your telescope at one star and then you start at one end of the band. It's like when you're listening to the radio, right?
Yeah.
And you slowly turn along, you know, trying to find a station, and then you get all the way to the end. And, you know, if you're driving down the road, then, you know, you might miss an entire station because you just come in and out of their broadcast range. And then you pick another star and then turn the radio dial, right?
Yeah, like, and there's only so much of a band that you can do. And so, you know, what we're trying to, I know that the plans right now are to do some more continuous sky monitoring rather than just the sit and turn the dial on one planet, on one star system at a time.
And so in this case, I sort of imagine them instead picking the number on the dial, but then just looking at everything all at the same time and going, is anybody at this, you know, in the Vela constellation, in this, you know, gigantic chunk of the sky broadcasting at this, in this, and nope, okay, then, you know, shift to another. So it's a, so it's a much wider scan. So Alan, what does this mean for the search for extraterrestrials? Is this it? Aliens denied?
No, I don't think so. I mean,
I hope not, or I'm out of one job right there.
No. We'll get your response, but you know, you're in the pocket of big aliens, so we'll let a completely neutral participant here. Alan has no, really no, you know, you're not invested in or against the discovery of aliens. So, so tell us.
I'm
what
quite comfortable saying there's nothing. It doesn't mean I'm right, though.
So what does this mean? Where are all the aliens?
I guess they're just hiding. Or maybe in January 2018 they had radio silence. Or more likely, that just any emissions in those areas are just not that strong. You know, I actually wanted to ask Beth, what are the odds of looking at something like light pollution? Just an idea that occurs to me right now, because how much energy are we pumping out just invisible lights to light our world? Was that something that you could possibly detect, do you think?
Well, and that's one of the things, that's one of the reasons that we're trying to look at optical SETI instead of transmission SETI, like looking for those transmissions. We're looking for different methods. So, the lights would be more of a, it's a technosignature, but it's also kind of a biosignature. So they're trying to, I know that we've turned like telescopes around and taken pictures of like, I think Hubble just did one of the Earth to see if they could detect life signs from it, from a distance, instead of, you know, trying to do it with planets that are so far away. Let's see, can we detect it from our own planet first and say that, you know, with some confidence that yes, there is life there. Now, can we take that and use it on other planets? So that is one of the things that they're looking at is whether or not you can sense, maybe not the actual light, but some of the molecular results of that light. So, you know, heating up and cooling down and that kind of thing.
And I mean, I think it's a fascinating search that they did. I mean, part of it is just a demonstration of the raw capability and power of the Murchison array. And this is, I wouldn't call it a stunt exactly, but the fact that they just, you know, turned it like, let's just see if we can see some aliens who happen to be in this enormous region of space, providing more data instantaneously than I know the SETI Institute has wanted to see for a long time. I mean, it's just, it would be great. Can you imagine if the SETI Institute had this kind of an observatory at their disposal for a dedicated search for extraterrestrials, as opposed to someone borrowing a little time to do a quick scan and then go back to searching for the, you know, the recombination era of the universe, which is, you know, the main job of these kinds of telescopes.
Well, you know, if anybody wants to send a lot of money SETI's way, we would love to build more telescopes at the ATA, because we only have 42 right now. And the plan was to have, I think, like 300. So, you know.
Christian Woodland is asking, would a setup on the moon with such equipment be any better? Yeah, the moon is the perfect place to put this technology. There's actually a proposal that someone put together for NASA to essentially land a spacecraft on the moon and then have it have a rover that would deploy a rover that would then crawl away from this lander and lay out. You saw those antennae. So imagine it was sort of dropping those antennae as it goes along some big long pathway and essentially build one of these radio telescopes on the moon. And of course, if you're on the far side of the moon, you're in the shadow of the moon from all of the Earth's electronic interference. So you have this pristine, perfect place to put one of these radio telescopes. There's a great capability. One of the things, for example, that it could do is it could detect solar flares interacting with the magnetospheres of extrasolar planets. So you can imagine watching an extrasolar planet around, you know, a planet around another star as it's buffeted by the solar wind, and you can see it protecting the planet. So if you already know that that planet is habitable, is within the habitable zone, you could determine whether or not it's got a magnetosphere, which is like a whole next level of habitability. So, the moon is like the best place to put a radio telescope like this. The square kilometer array on the moon? Yes, please. All right. Well, we've reached the end of our show. No aliens this week. Stay tuned next week. Maybe we'll find aliens. Before we get on with let you all escape for the evening, Beth, what are you working on?
I am working with CosmoQuest. I'm now one of the hosts of the Daily Space. I do a Friday planetary science sort of roundup. And starting this Friday, I'm also hosting Community After Hours, which is sort of my opposition to Community Coffee, which is 7:30 a.m. my time. And it turns out I don't do mornings. So I'm going to run an After Hours starting this Friday, just to kind of like discuss science, hang out, chill. Bring the beverage of your choice. Doesn't have to be caffeinated at all. And enjoy like just a nice relaxing end of week science hour.
Yeah. Right on. And if people want to find out more, so just go to CosmoQuest now and
yeah, for all the CosmoQuest. Things. It's on our calendars. It'll be on our Twitch stream. So twitch.tv/CosmoQuestX.
Fantastic. Nika, what are you working on?
Hi. So am I on mute? No. I was just testing. So, basically, I am currently part of the team Gaia Aerospace. It's a German, like a central German, the new space network. And basically, we do organize a lot of events. We support like young talents. We even have our own projects, space projects. And also, it's basically the goal is to connect the startups together and connect them to the agencies and to the established big names in the industry. And that's what I am doing currently. And we are planning some events and podcasts. So I will let you know once it's right going on.
If people want to find out more, where should they go?
Go to my Twitter.
Okay.
You guys already have it. So basically.
And in case they don't, what's your Twitter?
The Veronica Space.
Right on. Awesome. Alan, what are you working on?
So we are in the middle of the third season of the Urban Astronomer podcast. I was supposed to publish an episode tonight and I ran into some technical trouble. aside from that, though, I am hoping to be presenting a virtual lecture for the South African Astronomical Observatory's 200th anniversary events. They're having a science week, which was supposed to be a science week back when they were planning it at the beginning of the year. And I'm hoping if they will take me that I will present a talk on how orbital mechanics and space travel works using Kerbal Space Program.
Perfect.
I'm going to be a streamer for
yeah, perfect. Yeah. You're going to be a streamer. Yeah. Yeah. I always tell people that I learned more about orbital mechanics and space flight for playing Kerbal Space Program than I did for a decade of space reporting. You know, you talk about upper stages and gravitational slingshots and apogee, but when you actually have to make those little Kerbals complete their flight, it's a whole different story. Yeah. So where can people find out more?
I don't have a detail yet for that. It'll be, I will definitely announce it on my Twitter though, which you can find at uastronomer, letter U.
Right on. Okay, well, so a couple of people are asking what's going on with Universe Today. Yes, we have a star party. We're shifting the night of the star parties to Saturday night. Saturday night. So just remember that. And in theory, we're going to try this Saturday night. But the fires have taken at least four of our telescopes offline. So we've got really bad skies from San Francisco, California, Nevada, So we might be difficult for us to get good views to the night sky. We're going to try. I'm back with Open Space on Monday, and that's my live QA where I'll answer all your questions. We've got more question shows, more Guide to Space videos, and we've actually broken up the way we do the Open Space now, because I was having guests but also doing solo shows where I answer questions, and now I'm going to do one of each every week. So we'll do one of the question show and one of just a guest interview each week. So you don't have to choose which one you like better. You just get to have both. So I know the hiatus has been rough for all of you. We're almost over, and this is the first show to return. We've got an astronomy cast on Friday, so everything is back in business, and I hope you will have mountains of space learning over the next year. All right, I'm going to put everybody back on the screen. There they all are. Thank you, everybody, for joining us, returning with us to the weekly Space Hangout. I missed you. I missed you in the show with me, and I missed all of you in the chat as well. I realize I forgot to say hello to all of you at the beginning of the show. I'm rusty. They said this was going to be a disaster. Thanks to my co-hosts. Thanks to the moderators. Thanks, as always, to Nancy Graziano for all of her hard work in organizing everything. It's been great to have you working behind the scenes to get this all ready to go. I hope we did you proud.